Mr. Schwinn.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Steve Schwinn. I'm here representing the plaintiff appellant, Mr. Glenn Verser. We're asking that this Court reverse the trial court's denial of a new trial for Mr. Verser and order a new trial because Mr. Verser was denied his right to poll the jury in violation of Rule 48 when he was excused from the proceeding and excluded from the entire proceeding at the time that the jury was sent out to deliberate. The effect of this exclusion meant that Mr. Verser couldn't request a right to poll the jury at the appropriate time, and that means that he was denied his right to poll the jury. Under this Court's plain jurisprudence, that is per se error requiring reversal.
Your brief uses that phrase a lot, but I don't even understand what per se error is. Are you referring to what would now be called structural error?
We're contrasting per se error, Your Honor, with what my friend on the other side, Mr. Ilitz, would say is forfeiture.
Well, and maybe I need to be clear. To say something is error is not to say that something is reversible. Right? When something happens, if there's no poll on request, that's error. And it doesn't matter to me whether you call it obvious, blindingly obvious, screechingly obvious, or per se. If you violate a rule, that's error. Whether reversal follows from that is determined normally by the rules for plain error, harmless error, and so on. And in recent years, the Supreme Court has increasingly insisted that courts of appeals not reverse automatically. Last year's decision in DeVia, U.S. against DeVia, is a particularly vehement insistence. So if you're using per se error to say, gee whiz, if you violate a rule, that leads to automatic reversal, you've got a big problem with the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. If you're using it to mean something else, I just wonder what the something else is.
Your Honor, we're not stuck to the language per se error, obviously, but this Supreme Court...
What are you using it to mean? Are you using it to mean it's a blindingly obvious error, or are you using it to mean and reversal is automatic?
The latter principally, Your Honor.
All right.
But
well, then you've got problems with the Supreme Court.
Your Honor...
Any comment on DeVia?
Well, I don't at this point, Your Honor. I'd be happy to take a closer look at that ruling and submit a supplemental brief if it pleased the Court. But, Your Honor, this...
There have been, in courts of appeals, lines of cases that say something like, it's really very hard to show that a violation of a particular rule was harmful, and therefore we have to reverse automatically. Cases like DeVia expressly reject that approach. Right? That's what the old Seventh Circuit cases you're pointing to say, and we generally yield to more recent decisions of the Supreme Court. So perhaps I could ask you, in what way was this harmful if it was error?
First off, Your Honor, we don't concede that harmful error analysis applies. I understand, Your Honor.
But if it does, I have that same question.
But assume it does. Assume we follow the Supreme Court.
Well,
in what way was an error here harmful?
When the jury came back outside of Mr. Verser's presence in the first instance, and the foreman said to the judge, Your Honor, the foreman said, we can't
come to... I know exactly what happened in this case. In what way was the error harmful?
The error was harmful in that any reasonable attorney present under the circumstances would have requested a poll of the jury.
In what way was the error harmful?
Mr. Verser didn't.
That is, what... Maybe I could ask a different way. I feel particularly happy asking a professor of law this question. What data do we have about how often a poll of the jury reveals disagreement among the jury? In what percentage of polling cases does one juror stand up and say, this is not my verdict?
Your Honor, I don't have an answer to that question, but we would submit to the court that
if
that's
not...
If
we don't know that that ever happens... I'm sure it must happen from time to time. But if we don't know that it ever happens, how could one say that a lack of a poll in a particular case was harmful?
Your Honor, because it's the lack of the poll itself that is harmful. This
but
is a
you also might say that the entire run of cases where polls are asked for might not include expressions of reservations along the line that
that's
the jury
right.
expressed
right.
here. There's a subset.
There's this peculiar expression by this jury, so
that we're
you
dealing
know, the,
with.
If one would answer my question, it happens in 0.1% of cases. but it happens in 10% of cases where there's been some question from the jury or a reservation or something like that, that would go a long way to showing that there was potential harm here. But I take it we don't know what those numbers look like.
Your Honor, I don't know that there are empirical data to answer that question. I could look into it, and again, I'd be happy to submit a supplemental brief if it pleased the Court on that point. Our point is that harmful error does not apply in this situation, and if harmful error does apply...
I know that's your point, but as I say, we're going to follow the Supreme Court.
I understand.
You've got a long string of cases by the Supreme Court that post-date any reference by this circuit to per se error. That's no longer even the Supreme Court's vocabulary.
Well, they speak of structural
error. There's normal
error
and there's structural error, but there isn't any such thing as per se error.
That's true. But on the other hand, there are a few things that are structural error, and so things that, particularly given the curtain that we have to put up that separates us from the jury's deliberations, this is not necessarily an area where you couldn't find that. You do have the benefit, if you will, of this colloquy. I have a slightly different question for you, which is what one should do if confronted with a situation that the drafters of the rules apparently didn't even consider. You have Rule 48C talking about the right to a poll. There's nothing in the wording of that rule that makes me suspect that the drafters had any notion that there would be situations where a pro se criminal defendant, you know, criminal plaintiff, you know, bringing a 1983 case or something like that, has been removed, I'll stipulate for myself, for valid security reasons from the courtroom. We all agree that judges have a lot of discretion over that. And what do you do if it's not, you know, the lawyer who decided to go shopping, you know, or something at issue, but instead a real conflict in serious things? If there's a gap in the rules, do you poll? Do you not poll? Do you tell the rule drafters, close the gap? What do you do?
Well, Judge Wood, that's a hard question and one that this panel had certified for oral argument. We proposed some solutions in our blue brief and in our gray brief. I think that there are others that are available out there as well. It's not clear to me, however, that the drafters of the Rule of 48 didn't contemplate this kind of situation. Although, Your Honor, they may not have contemplated it specifically, the way the rule reads, and we spell this out in our textual argument in the gray brief, the way the rule reads suggests that the timing of the poll has to happen after the jury returns its verdict.
Now, and the rule seems to think that somebody's there from both sides.
The Supreme Court held long ago that parties are entitled to be present when the jury communicates with the judge, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Could I ask a question here, a couple of questions, Mr. Schwinn? If I understood correctly, the defense argument at trial was, in essence, nothing bad happened to Mr. Verser. Is that right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Nothing bad.
The defense at trial from the defendants was, no, we didn't beat up Mr. Verser.
That's correct.
Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
The jury came back and said, in essence, we believe something did happen to Mr. Verser, but we just don't see evidence of it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Let me ask you about whether that might have been the result of the combination of this instruction and the pro se status of Mr. Verser. Arguments, statements, and remarks of counsel and of Mr. Verser, who is his own counsel, are intended to help you in understanding the evidence and applying the law, but are not evidence. Which could be understood, I would suggest, to by a juror who takes that very literally, to say we can't treat what Mr. Verser said in any capacity in court as evidence.
It seems
so,
Your
Honor. Was there something that clarified that for the jury somewhere?
I have nothing to clarify that from the record, Your Honor. That statement seems to stand on its own. And we have no indication from the jury why there was some equivocation on the part of the jury or why they thought that something happened, but there just wasn't evidence to show it. We don't have that because, in part, Mr. Verser was denied his right to poll the jury to expose that kind of equivocation or that kind of problem in open court. The problem here, Your Honor, is that by excluding Mr. Verser from the time that the jury read its verdict until the end of the trial, Mr. Verser had no opportunity under this court's plain jurisprudence to request a poll of the jury. Now, this court has described that as plain error, error. I understand the court's position that that may have changed under Supreme Court rulings. But I want to emphasize, Your Honors, that this is a very special kind of right. This court and other courts have been clear it's not a constitutional right, to be sure, but it's a substantial right, and it's a unique kind of right. If it's not granted to a litigant at the appropriate time, then we can't see the kind of equivocation that the rule is designed to reveal in open court when the jury comes back. And that, Your Honors, is precisely the problem in this case. When Mr. Verser was unable to request a poll of the jury, he was unable to get the jury's unequivocal consent to the verdict in the way, Judge Hamilton, you're suggesting, that might reveal some kinds of problems that happened in the jury room or some misunderstanding or some literal understanding of a judge's instruction that, taken literally, was incorrect. Your Honors, I see my time has expired. May I simply ask for our relief?
Mm-hmm.
Your Honors, we would request that this court reverse and order a new trial under this court's plain jurisprudence that a denial of the right to poll the jury is per se error requiring reversal. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Schwinn. Mr. Ehlitz.
Good morning, Your Honors. Illinois Assistant Attorney General Carl Ehlitz for the four state prison guard defendants counsel. May it please the court. Your Honor, there's two issues that I see are percolating. One is, what should the rule be if there is a problem in this circumstance where a litigant is removed from the courtroom for valid security reasons? What should the judge do with regard to the right to poll? And the other is whether there was harmless error here. I'll start with the question is, assuming there's a problem here, what should the rule be? Because we have on the one side the recognition that the court has an obligation to maintain security in the courtroom.
I didn't see anything in the record that justified the exclusion of Mr. Verser. There are holding cells at Urbana, right?
I don't know, but I believe that's probably correct.
I've checked. There are.
There are.
There's no indication of misbehavior during the trial, was there?
Well, Your Honor,
no.
There was not.
No.
He's under guard, but he's also
double guard. He's got two guards with
sure.
him.
Sure, and that's perfectly normal. But I don't understand how that justifies excluding him from the process of dealing with the deliberating jury.
We don't know whether the jury would deliberate for an hour or a day or a day and a half.
I know.
Mr. Verser was convicted of murder. He had been convicted of escape from a penal institution. He is a security threat whenever he leaves Stateville. He's exposed to other prisoners in the courthouse prison. So I think it's a matter of great discretion with the trial court to whether he should be removed.
I can imagine a district judge making that kind of record. None was made here.
Well, we know what
it would be a lot easier if the district judge had said something like, the holding cells available in this courthouse, which is not a large courthouse, mm-hmm. are needed for some other ongoing trial. So mm-hmm. there's a security problem with Verser in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Judge didn't say anything like that. Do you know whether that was true?
No, and what he said simply was, you guys are out of here.
But that's not much of a record.
It's not any of a record.
But, Your Honor, there was no objection.
You'd think the judge would just send the plaintiff to one of the holding cells.
Sure, but
and
Mr. Verser didn't object.
Since you were the litigant who wanted him sent back, or rather the state of Illinois wanted him back, that you might have asked the district judge to make a record about that.
Your Honor,
and on
I don't
top of
rec-
that, when you say he didn't object, he didn't
he's
have any reason
prisoner.
To object where he was going to be lodged, but nobody said to him, and by the way, it means you won't be there when the jury comes back, so you won't be able to ask for a poll.
We won't bother to bring you back,
we
for
won't
example,
bother
if
to even
the jury
phone.
Asks for clarification of instructions,
right.
which happens all the time.
Absolutely. Other times when he has a right to be there.
Your Honor, I wasn't the trial lawyer in this case, but
no.
I did speak to the trial lawyer. I don't know that we have any great concern what happened to Mr. Verser. We didn't ask that he be returned to Stateville.
Yeah, but we have a concern about what
I
happened
think
to Verser.
The decision
we're trying,
to send
we're trying to figure out how we're going to deal with prisoner litigants, both in whether they should be sent back to prison instantly after the trial is over, and then if that happens, what's going to happen with questions from the jury? We had one of those, and with polls of the jury.
Yes. And in a civil case, there are no constitutional rights to be there, Your Honor. you had mentioned that, a party has a right to be in court, but in a civil case, the rules are slightly different. But
That's actually from a civil case from 1919 from the U.S. Supreme Court.
If there are concerns for security, assuming...
I mean, one can waive the right, of course, in a civil case, but nobody sees that for Mr. Verser. He's, as far as he knows, he's just being parked somewhere until he needs to come back.
There are two possibilities here if we're concerned about the conflict between prison security and the right to poll the jury. The one is Professor Schwinn's suggestion that the court conduct a per se poll. The rule doesn't require that. The Constitution doesn't require that. There's nothing that would suggest that. I would suggest from these cases.
But the rule doesn't contemplate that the litigant will have been kicked out of the courtroom in a way that holds him incommunicado. It wasn't simply that he was excluded. He wasn't sent out with a cell phone so he could get ongoing updates.
The critical point to that concern, Your Honor, that I have is that he did not object here. He did not say, Your Honor, please do not exclude me.
How did he know he wasn't going to be brought back?
I mean, the answer to that might be, I think the judge said, we'll send you the verdict by mail.
He did. That's
which
exactly.
Pretty much suggested that he was gone.
But how on earth do we expect him to raise this objection as a pro se litigant?
Well, Your Honor,
let me ask something else that troubled me, Mr. Elitz. It looked like you tell us in your brief that the judge denied the motion for a new trial, based at least in part on the juror's later private comments to the judge.
That's what Judge Baker's order references. He talks about both what happened on the record after the trial, and then there was a period of time when the jury discussed the case with him.
And that's pretty troubling, isn't it?
It would be, except for the fact that he also based it on what was on the record, and we have what's in the record here. And what that is the jurors telling the judge that they did not like the fact that something happened to Mr. Verser, and that, but there wasn't sufficient evidence to find that he had been assaulted, as Mr. Verser alleged.
What was the jury told about Mr. Verser's testimony and whether it was evidence in light of the instruction I quoted earlier that said what he says is not evidence?
Your Honor, I didn't focus on that question when I was looking at this record. There were 12 issues or so raised in the opening brief. That wasn't one of them. But there was another witness who testified, another prisoner, who testified that he had heard no scuffle.
But Mr. Verser's testimony, of course, was evidence. We don't have a party disqualification rules. And if the jury might have thought it wasn't because of his dual role, that's a problem. If the jury thinks there's one person to stand up for what happened, and there are really two, it's quite a different situation.
I believe there was no objection to that particular jury instruction. I don't recall reading any concern over that one. I don't believe it's plain error either, because what I heard Judge Hamilton read seemed like it was accurate. Now, it may not have been the best instruction.
Accurate as long as the judge makes clear to the jury that at certain points in the trial, Verser was testifying and that's evidence. My question is whether that happened. I don't know yet.
I don't believe there's any discussion of this issue at all below, either before or after Professor Schwinn was appointed for Mr. Verser.
Well, the reason that I'm raising is because it at least offers a potential explanation
for the
jury's question and troubles and comments, and also suggests a basis for concluding that this error might not have been harmless.
There's another explanation as well, Your Honor. One of the other prisoner testified that the four guards, who are my clients, used offensive language and pretended, though, as if Mr. Verser was resisting the cell transfer. Okay. So it's possible, under the jury's hearing this evidence, that they believe that he was harassed. But that sort of harassment would not rise to the level of being a violation of his constitutional rights. And so that makes perfect sense that they would come back and say something happened to Mr. Verser. Mr. Verser had no injuries. He made no contemporaneous objection after the guards were gone. There's no suggestion here that he was physically injured, which was his 1983 claim. So that's what I would suggest the jury was thinking when they reported back to Judge Baker that something had happened to him. I think if we do go to a harmless error analysis, that's where the court should go, because that explains the verdict completely. And
that's what that seems to tell me is we've got alternative explanations that are plausible, but it's hard to conclude that the error is harmless.
I think one
explanation is harmful, one is not. But usually when we get into that situation, we can't say the error was harmless.
But we also can't attribute the resolution of that to a jury poll when the jury came back and explained what their logic was and then had an exchange with Judge Baker on the record and explained that they felt that there wasn't substantial evidence to find. Now, I realize that you're raising a new issue, but I would suggest that that issue is forfeit, especially after Mr. Verser got counsel and it wasn't raised.
It's part of the question of harm. For the error that has been the focus of the supplemental briefing and argument. So.
I would ask the court to defer to Judge Baker, who was there and heard the evidence and saw the jury and talked to the jury afterwards and came to the conclusion that this jury delivered what he characterized as a just and true verdict after all of this was discussed. I would suggest in the short amount of time that I have that to the extent that there's a concern, the right to poll a jury is protected by a pro se litigant who's excluded by his making a request. You can do it any time before.
There's no law that says you can make it before the verdict comes back anywhere. And indeed, quite a few cases that would have come out differently if you could make an advance request.
I think it's consistent with the language of the rule that the request can come before.
But isn't it troubling that it's never been done and never been thought to have been done? I mean, we would have quite a different system if we just let people say, you know, Judge, I am going to go shopping, but, you know, here's my request for a poll. You might not even want a poll, depending on what the verdict is. I think
absolutely
that's a strategic
not. The poll, you don't want to know.
The poll request would need to be contingent.
Exactly.
If Verser had won this, he wouldn't be asking for a poll.
The request would need to be contingent. Your Honor, I'd ask that the court affirm the judgment in favor of the four state defendants. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we invite the parties to file supplemental memoranda within 14 days. Covering any empirical literature on what happens when there are polls of the jury. If there is any, there may not be any, and if there's nothing, there's nothing, but it would be interesting to know what there is. Counsel, we particularly thank your willingness, Mr. Schwinn, we particularly thank you for your willingness to accept the appointment at the court's invitation and to provide representation for somebody who otherwise lacks it. So thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.